Testing 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Well, we've got you married, and in a digression, and we did have one other item that, if you remember, we had trouble switching the tape, and I didn't want to continue on that. That was, you were dealing with your staff, and I had just asked you whether you thought that you were followed and monitored very closely.
By the Chinese,
and particularly by your staff.
Yeah,
and
by the house staff.
By the house staff.
Well, I think I said there was never any evidence of that. And there was never any evidence of any bothering with my private papers, which I kept those that were of more consequence under lock and key, of course, but many times there was stuff around. And, my driver, Dagua, big Guo, Mr. Guo, had a reputation among the political section of the liaison offices as being a high-ranking member of the public security. I think that came from the fact that he was big and burly and a tough driver. You know, they didn't have to keep particular track of me to know where I was going. There was one little incident. We got a mix-up on dates. We had been invited to, this was later on, to go to dinner at the Norwegian Embassy. And apparently they could not get enough additional guests, and they called the dinner off but neglected to call me to tell me. So we go out there on this Saturday night, and they were, happened to be home. They were surprised to see us, of course, invited us in for a drink. We were there maybe half an hour and getting ready to leave when the phone rings. And it's from me, from the Chinese, wanting to know if I can come to a meeting the next morning with the vice premier and with an American group. I forget which, it was a business group in any event. And I wondered how they knew I was there, because my schedule was printed and floated around pretty freely, so it could have been in any event. Anyway, we then were to leave. We went to look for my driver, and of course he'd gone. He wasn't anywhere around, assuming we were there for dinner. And since there was nobody else around, nobody to feed him, he went to take care of himself. But that was the only incident directly involving me. Now, as far as surveillance was concerned, we kept track. We could keep track of that with our own resources, and the only, not in the early days that I was there, but in the later days, Chris Ballou, who was the station chief, he was tailed. But they would only pick him up when he got outside of a radius of about 2 to 3 kilometers of our liaison office. And then we had evidence that he was picked up, but that evidence wasn't true for anybody else, including myself or the DCM. So there was certainly none of that feeling, but you had to operate and proceed on the assumption that most of the things that you talked about, as you know, we had the conference room in the basement, which was supposedly...
Is the existence of that classified itself, the tank, or not?
I assume that the Chinese must know about it. I think, again, it's one of those things that, that since they accept it as a fact of life, they're not going to challenge or worry about. We used to have all of our senior staff meetings, which we had at that time three times a week, later on twice a week. We'd just have them in my office. And it was not until till later on, well after normalization, that most of the stuff we talked about in those meetings was routine and not of consequence. But once in a while, you get into something which might be considered a little bit delicate. But we then began routinely to hold up all those meetings in the tank. But all of these things were routine precautions. And to get back to the household staff, if they were, they were experts and extremely professional, because one never had any such feeling. Nor was there any undue curiosity.
No sign, too, that the kind of electronic surveillance was directed at the embassy as has been directed at our embassy in Moscow.
No. Every time we got new security personnel, which was pretty frequent because they had short tours, particularly when a new chief would come in, we'd go through all the routine of checking things out. And the residence in particular, as well as the office, was swept time and time again. Couldn't find anything. And our security people would say, well, they built it. If we built it, we'd do it. So we just assume it's there. But we never found anything. And we had the one incident, and I don't know whether I mentioned this one. We had a fairly high-ranking Chinese delegation came to the house. They were a delegation going to the U.S. And one of their principals left behind a briefcase, which, along with some other materials, was picked up by the house staff and brought immediately to Sharon, thinking it belonged to the Americans, who frequently left stuff behind. And Sharon takes it all up front to the office. Well, some of it did belong to Americans, but they discover then this briefcase, which they take back to, they take all the contents out. The contents are taken away from where the briefcase was into the political section to be copied. And then the Chinese come back looking for their briefcase. And they meet Sharon. Oh, she said, I thought that was one of ours, and I took it up front. So she goes up front and asks for the briefcase. So the receptionist goes back to where the briefcase had been taken, and there was the briefcase lying open and empty. They shut up the briefcase and take it to Sharon and gives it to the Chinese, who took it away. And they never said anything about that. There was one piece in there which purported to be the transcript of a meeting involved. This incident took place after normalization. This was a meeting in which Deng Xiaoping was involved with relation to the U.S. Nothing very startling, but obviously classified. It would be classified material to us. I forget just.
Oh, this was a talk that he gave.
Right, and it was recorded. I think we got the materials back to them, or maybe they became aware at the point that the briefcase was being taken out, and they hustled it. Anyways, a botched up amateurish job. We looked very bad, but the Chinese never made a fuss about it. Never said, why did you do that, and breach of hospitality and all the rest of it. So that...
I remember how that was disseminated in Washington, then it comes across, just the source, totally protected. I remember that. It was a good find.
So, after I get back in February, my appointment book shows I was very busy still, I've said, finishing out my job of paying courtesy calls and other ambassadors, although it's now 9 months since I arrived, and doing many other such things, so very busy, but really with detail. And then I had been invited to go to a meeting in India, in Delhi. It was a gathering of the worldwide gathering, yes, of labor attachés. And I had been asked to come and talk to them about the situation in China and the relationship. And so I accepted and went through Hong Kong, spent a day there. Took advantage too of that visit to reestablish relations with the Indian trade union officials whom I had known from my previous trade union activities, and had a luncheon with given for me by President Bhagavati for the INTUK leadership, that's the Indian National Trade Union Congress. Stayed at the residence, and the ambassador the following day gave a dinner for the American labor group and invited Indian trade unionists. And I was somewhat surprised to find that was the first time Indian trade unionists had been in the American embassy. Yeah, they're a fairly consequential force in political and other terms in India.
I'm surprised to hear that was the first time.
Yes, the ambassador himself told me that. Said he was glad of the opportunity. Although we had a labor attaché attached to the Indian embassy. When I spoke to the conference, the AFL-CIO had a delegation there, which was headed by President Ward of the Plumbers Union, who he and I were fairly good friends, but it also included, there were five of them. They've been in Japan, included a couple of Taiwan hardliners, and they had let it be known they were going to come to the meeting at which I spoke and really take me on about, I presume, soft on communism and the rest of it. But when we had the session, although we had a big gathering, all five of the AFL-CIO people were not present, so there was no confrontation.
What, who were the two, do you recall?
I forget the names. It probably included, what's the name of the man? Lee, who was George Meany's son-in-law.
Was he George Meany's son-in-law? I just met him at a Council on Foreign Relations session where he came on.
He's a
very strong anti-PRC.
Right, and has a very simplistic notion of what the communist
is he what, close
forces
with Lee
are in
Kirkland?
The, I don't know. I haven't. I'm not aware of what changes. Is he still head of their foreign? Well, he probably is. You know, I used to say that George Meade felt his opposition to communism in his heart. There were those who said Jay Lovestone sold him on the Bill of Goods. You didn't have to sell that to George Meany. He just had an Irish Catholic immediately responsive reaction. Lane Kirkland, it's more a mental process. And of course he takes much of his feeling from his, I think from his wife, former Israeli, and it's a pretty hard line on that. You know, it was Kirkland himself, I discovered, who called Haig to block visas being given to a delegation from the All China Trade Union Federation when they were coming here at invitation of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations. I got involved to see if I could do something to unravel it. Well, that, when I discovered Kirkland himself had called Haig, there was nothing I could do to reverse that. There was some hope, too, that there would be an issue at the AFL-CIO convention that was just held a couple of months ago. But it would have been a mistake take such an issue, because it would probably certainly been Kirkland, where he was, been defeated and have had greater consequences than simply a delegation not coming. But
well, part of the Mr. Lee's representation, if that was at all behind this first of the contact in India too, is the fear that China just represents another cheap labor market, which will be a source of massive imports to the U.S. That was the view expressed, at least at the meeting I attended.
Well, of course, that's an obvious. Once you have the basic position, that's an obvious argument.
Yeah.
But there are those who are really concerned about that, like Chick Chaikin of the Ladies' Garment Workers, and Murray Finley, and Jack Shankman of the Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers, who don't proceed from that worry, which is a deep worry to them, to an automatic opposition. And they accept the necessity for better relations and cast about for ways to try and protect their position in other ways. But it's, you know, many labor people look at China, they look at what Japan has done to us, and they think, my God, China's got 10 times as many people as Japan. Therefore, we're nurturing 10 Japans, and if Japan has almost put us out of business, we may as well file bankruptcy. File bankruptcy right now. When I talk to them, I say that China has, like we have, a continental economy with much plus resources. They're not comparable. Japan has to export or die because she has no natural resources. That is not true of China. Yes, they have to export, particularly in their developing phase when they need the foreign currency for capital imports. But their own needs are going to be so great that for decades to come, they'll be feeding their own market just as we did. It's only within the last 10-15 years that foreign trade became more than a very small percent of our total trade, five or less, right? And it's now up to, what, 8, 10, 11. And that also is a reflection of the exhaustion of some of our own natural resources. But the visit to India was very beneficial. the conference. Well, I wouldn't go a long way just to go to such a conference, very frankly. I took advantage, of course, to make the inevitable visit to the Taj Mahal at Agra, which is certainly worth every effort to go. But on the way back, we went some distance away to Fatehpur Sikri to see the old Mughal capital. Then we got lost. We had an embassy car, of course, with an Indian driver. And we got lost trying to find our way back to the Delhi-Agra road and went through many Indian villages. And I was really struck by the poverty in those villages and the lack of sanitation with many, if not all of them, open sewers running down the middle of what was the one street through the town, through the village, with the children just playing in it. And the contrast between that and China was really striking. And I remember the Intook president, Bhagavati, saying to me, in India we have freedom. In China they have security. And now our fight is to get security. Of course, this was before the Gandhi moves took place, a couple of years later. But it really was very striking and made considerable impression on me. The Indian ambassador to China, Narayanan, was on home leave. Well, he wasn't on home leave. He had great trouble in China. He and I, as I think I've said, had become very good friends. And he was troubled with respiratory and other problems in China. And I had a very pleasant visit with him and also with Jayut Mehta, the foreign secretary of India, who, although politically appointed, is the foreign secretary, is the highest ranking civil servant.
Now, the ambassador was a force to try to improve Sino-Indian relations, as I understood.
Yes.
And felt a certain frustration with his own government at that time. Or was Gandhi still in office?
No.
At this time? No. Oh, the new leaders were moving toward a relationship with China.
Narayanan was sent in connection with, and Mehta had been appointed as foreign secretary by Gandhi and was kept on by the coalition government. As I say, although politically appointed, was the ranking civil servant under their system, not the foreign minister, the foreign secretary.
And, remind me, who was the prime minister at that time? I've forgotten his name.
Oh, the man in his 80s who used to drink his
own pee.
Drink urine. Oh, how can we forget? But we had a very interesting discussion about China, and it was clear that they had some desire to improve relations with China, but were extremely wary. And then I went up through Calcutta. And on the plane that I took out of Delhi to go to Calcutta, Indira Gandhi was on that plane. She was going down for a mass meeting in Calcutta. In fact, our consulate there had called and suggested I take a later plane because they thought we'd have trouble getting from the airport to the consulate. But I stuck to the schedule I had. There were some few people to see her off, but she was all by herself on the plane. I half rose out of my seat on one occasion because there was a vacant seat next to her to go and talk to her. kicked myself ever since that I didn't. But we get to Calcutta, and the Consul General was there to greet me, and in his car, of course, flying the flag. Well, there's a fair-sized group at the airport to see her. And we left before she did, of course, because she had to go through a brief ceremony there. And we took the same route into town that she was to follow, so that at every intersection there was a huge gathering and pressed against the car. But it was very jovial, very friendly. As I say, we were flying the flag, both the consulate flag and the American flag. And there were no incidents of any kind. I'd had in Delhi a gathering at the house of the economic counselor, Nat Balaki, who got together a group of Indian intellectuals. And I've met Indian intellectuals on occasion, usually in singly, most two or three. But they do strike me as about the most arrogant people in the world. And in this luncheon in particular, they had all the answers to any problem that came up. It was a very interesting luncheon, but that was the impression I
extremely kept. Articulate.
Oh, very, very bright, very articulate. And that was the impression I got. And there was a stag luncheon at the consulate in Calcutta. These, however, were all journalists invited by the Consul General, Perkins. And that was a much more realistic luncheon, talking about the politics in India, and they were surprisingly forthright. Then went on from there to Rangoon, and spent a couple of days there to do some sightseeing, and one full day really. And the ambassador gave a luncheon to which the PRC ambassador, Mo Yen Chung, came. First time any Chinese official had been in our embassy in Burma. Not only just the ambassador, but other top officials from the Chinese embassy. And then that night had a chance to meet Burmese officials, including one woman who was in the Foreign Office and who was apparently the China expert in the Burmese government, who spent a good many years in China. And who reputedly was very close to Deng Xiaoping. And her reputation was of being very, very strongly pro-PRC. And left there, Don Kaiser from the embassy had been our delegate to this labor attaché's conference, because he had that function in the liaison office for what it was worth. It wasn't worth very much. And so we flew to Kunming.
Worth the trip to India.
It was worth the trip to India, right. We flew to Kunming.
Let me just stay on the Burma question with Don Kaiser there, because there is an interesting question about the Sino-Burmese relationship, namely whether or how, I should say, one reconciles Chinese statements continually to Ne Win that they would cease support of insurgency movements and their continuation, in fact, of doing so. Jay Taylor, who was your political officer at the end, has written a very good book on China and Southeast Asia. I don't know whether you've read it.
No.
But he advances the argument, tries to document it, that in fact there were two policies toward Burma, pursued by different factions in Peking. And the Gang of Four was very much for this guerrilla movement. And Deng and Zhou Enlai was trying to put a damper on it, never fully succeeded. And I wonder whether Don had briefed you on that or whether you'd pursued that idea with the Burmese.
Didn't pursue it with the Burmese, but I was aware of it, the distinction drawn between the government-to-government relations and the party-to-party relations. That particular aspect did not surface in these discussions. When we got to Kunming, we came in on a CAAC flight, which stops in Kunming, then goes on to Peking, but we were going to stay in Kunming. At this point, this is March, of course, of 1978, there had not been very many foreigners in Kunming, and particularly not coming in from Rangoon. So we are received by the normal CITS person, but then three members of the public security come up to keep going, examining our papers and examining them, and looking at us as though we'd dropped in from Mars. And I saw no Chinese officials during the time in Kunming. Struck by the fact of all the work they were doing in restoring the Buddhist temples and other sites, obviously with an eye to the hoped for tourist trade, and spent a day going to see the Stone Forest, which is certainly one of the wonders of the world, and then went back to Peking. A UAW delegation had been in Japan, headed by Vice President Pat Greathouse. There were seven of them, and I'd invited them to come to Peking as our personal guests, my personal guests, which they did, and just were in Peking, and then went back. And at the same time...
Now, you had no questions within the UAW on the normalization side. It's with the AFL-CIO, did you?
No. That long before I was named, we had in our convention resolutions been supportive of the normal relationship between China and the U.S. So it was not just supporting me.
How far back did that go? I didn't think I'd forgotten covering that with you. First set of interviews. Did that precede?
These were not separate resolutions. We used to have omnibus resolutions, which would cover a host of things. And went back at least 3 or 4 years, if not more.
But after the Kissinger visit, or even antedating that?
I don't think it predated the opening of 71-72, no, but I think we were supporting it. Oh, no, I know we were. We were supportive of the Nixon-Kissinger move and continued. And going beyond that, I think, it would have been a decade, right? It would have been a decade. And then we had a CODEL came at that time, co-chaired by Henry Royce, the House Banking and Currency Committee, and Lloyd Benson, from the Senate Finance Committee.
That was a White House delegation.
That was one of the White House delegations, right? A very good delegation.
As I recall, we had a great deal of trouble getting a chairman for that delegation. Not many people wanted to go on that trip. China was really low on the priorities at that time in Washington.
Yeah, I think that's correct. Then Paul Findlay came with an Illinois agricultural group, and with the Great House group and the Royce Benson group, the only time I could be with them was at a breakfast at the hotel. They, however, had brought a lot of food into the country and had used the kitchen and the dining room and the residence to put on a typical Illinois feast for the Chinese, which I was told, I'm sorry, I wasn't there, went very well.
It was with a lot of soybeans.
Soybeans.
Was this the one that Findlay brought a pig with him?
Big Jim. Big Jim. Big Jim was named after Jim Thompson, the new governor of Illinois, who's still governor. And Big Jim weighed 300 is too much?
No, that's not too much for a hog.
I think it's 350 pounds.
Yeah, 250 is not big for a hog.
350 pounds.
Would be a big hog.
And following this breakfast, the whole group was going out to the pen where Big Jim was, where he was going to be formally presented to the Chinese. Unfortunately, I had another event that I had to go to, and although I was urged to go, I never met Big Jim, who died, by the way, after a couple of years. He died an early death, and I never could find out what happened.
Presumably after fathering a few more little Jims.
Oh, yes. That was the prime purpose of bringing him, right.
Paul Findlay was very supportive of normalization. He deserves a little footnote.
Paul Findlay certainly was. I discovered that back in February of 78. No, it was earlier than that. It was when I went back from Washington in October for the meeting with Secretary Vance and the rest. I took an early morning flight into Newark. Paul Findlay was on that same flight, and we shared a cab into Manhattan. And that's when I learned of his position. He was strongly supportive. And
very thoughtful person.
Right.
Very, as with I. With his position in the Middle East.
A
courageous man.
His position in the Middle East got him into a lot of trouble in the last congressional election.
Right.
But he survived it.
That's right. But he is a courageous
right.
political figure, and with a sense of world affairs.
He's on domestic matters, he's quite conservative, but he has a global sense and the courage of his mm-hmm. convictions.
And he was helpful in the Illinois delegation as a whole, by the way, on China policy. A number of the Illinois Republicans deferred to him. Michaels, Congressman Michaels, with whom he is a good friend. Paul Simon, I think, who is a Democrat, isn't he? But
yes.
There's another Republican. There were three.
Now, Paul Simon on China was not good.
I didn't realize that.
In fact, that surprised me because Paul Simon and I were fairly close. I was heavily involved in campaigning in Illinois, and Paul at one time ran for lieutenant governor, and in fact I think he was lieutenant governor, and I campaigned for him in his district. And I remember going in somewhere in this period to talk to him, just assuming he'd be all right. To my great surprise, and I might even say shock, he was different on this one. Now, I think Findlay and possibly myself may have restrained him from doing anything about it, but he was very suspicious of making the move. And I know the congressional delegation met with Vice Premier Gung Biao. They did not meet with Deng Xiaoping. Of course, at that time, there wasn't the great desire to meet with Deng Xiaoping. That developed later. Then I note that early in April, the calendar is still all filled.
Let me just interrupt at this point as we go over this. As I recall, I don't remember the date, but I believe that we communicated through our direct channel with you during this month of March to elicit your view about a Brzezinski visit. Or else, no, I think that's how we did it. Or did we have someone carry a letter? No, I think it was a special channel cable.
I think it was a special channel.
And at this point, you decided that it would be, you cabled affirmatively.
Exactly, right. That's the way I felt by that time.
That was important because by April, the Brzezinski visit had been scheduled.
Then I note that early in April, the Swiss embassy gave a dinner. Ambassador Sig. It was in honor of an Anton Andor Foldis, who was a pianist living in Switzerland, but an American citizen. And he was to give a recital followed by a dinner. And since Foldis was an American citizen, it was arranged that Sharon and I will sit at table number one. But the dean of the diplomatic corps, who always, of course, would be the ranking person representing the whole corps, was not able to come to the dinner, which meant that the senior ambassador on the protocol list would automatically become the ranking person. Just after the recital and before we go into dinner, the ranking person is the North Korean ambassador, who, when he hears that I am to be at the table, insists he will not sit with me. Poor Swiss ambassador was really caught in the middle, and I said, well, put me at some other table. And so I went to some other, Sharon and I went to some other table. Everybody else was drawing lots as to what table they went to. And it so happened that just as we were finally to go into dinner, a more senior person arrived than he, but by this time I said, no. I said, we will not go back to our old places. But the North Korean ambassador, there were certain representatives of certain countries with whom he would not associate in social events, not just the U.S. And he'd been known on more than one occasion. He'd inquire beforehand, and hearing that such and such people would be there would refuse, but on at least two occasions where he had appeared, not knowing that certain people were there and seeing them, just turned on his heel and left.
Did you have similar instructions?
No.
So you could social...